actual face-off against the U.S. directly with this initiative taken by the Secretary General of Hezbollah.
No matter what you do, we will be victorious. You can put sanctions on us and try to keep us in the cold, but we will defeat you. You cannot beat us or defeat our Sayyid.
Men, women, and children chanted as they welcomed the tankers. They say if it weren't for Iran and Syria, what would have happened to them?
I cannot express my happiness now. I want to thank Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. They give us victory.
These little girls insisted on expressing their feelings towards Hezbollah for initiating the import of fuel in their own way.
We love Sayyid Hassan because he is the father of all Lebanese, and he gives us pride and dignity.
Experts believe the arrival of Iranian fuel through Syria means more than mere fuel supply for months to come.
This is a courageous and historic step that very strongly broke the sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies in Lebanon. This step came to say no to the attempts to starve the Lebanese people, very similar to World War sanctions. We all know that the resistance that paid its blood to liberate land won't stop at anything to provide for its people. True, this is diesel, but it smells of dignity and pride. It smells of the blood of martyrs that quenched the thirst of this land.
The tankers have unloaded their contents in several reservoirs in the Bekaa, where they will in turn be distributed to institutions and individuals in all Lebanese areas depending on demand. The first four Iranian fuel tankers docked in Syria's Banias port earlier this week. Lebanon has been mired since late 2019 in a deep financial crisis that has caused the Lebanese pound to lose around 90% of its value to the dollar. The U.S. has exacerbated the crisis by imposing a siege on Lebanon.
Some 65 heavily loaded fuel tankers have reached Lebanon, dispelling any doubt over Hezbollah's ability to import fuel due to U.S. sanctions. Hezbollah's initiative is seen not only as part of a long-term solution to the fuel crisis, but also as a strategic blow to any U.S. attempt to marginalize the resistance movement. Maryam Saleh, Al Ain, Al Bekaa.
Is the UK turning into a totalitarian state? Well, according to former British Home Secretary David Blunkett, they are certainly heading in that direction, with the proposed police crime and sentencing courts bill, which is being debated this week. He is not alone. 600,000 Brits put their name to a petition calling for the bill to be dropped, including 700 academics. 245 organisations have also called the bill an attack on fundamental rights, along with three UN special rapporteurs and the UK's Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, who called the bill, quote, oppressive and wrong. While there are many aspects of the legislation that has worried rights groups and advocates since the bill was proposed, there is one particular aspect that has recently begun raising eyebrows.
The bill proposes to increase the sentence length for assault on emergency workers from 12 months to 2 years. On the surface, this may seem appropriate, but what some activists are concerned about is the way that this will disproportionately target people from ethnic minority backgrounds who are already significantly more likely to have force used against them than their white counterparts.
Dean alleges he was attacked by British police officers back in 2013 in the city of Manchester, but somehow found himself charged with resisting arrest.
But again, I'm 6'2", quite a big lad. Straight away, the police officer see my body as a weapon, and I got the whole, he's resisting. Next thing you know, I've got six police officers on my back, like punching me, kicking me, doing whatever. They can do things to people like me and people like you with the full knowledge that the law fully protects them. And even when, like I say, when I was basically attacked by the police, all of the officers who were there kind of corroborated the same story, which was false.
Marco, not his real name, has a similar story. He was at an anti-racist demonstration when police were seen attacking protesters, yet Marco found himself charged with assaulting emergency services. Marco asked us to distort his voice.
The police were using me.
This was clear in court by the footages, that the police were using disproportionate force and there was no real reason for doing that. And they even confirmed that in their witness testimony in court. And it was incredible to see that they could just claim in court that they were just punching people in the face to stop them from going to Trafalgar Square. And this was used against me, ultimately, just because I was defending myself and those around me.
Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Nowadays, landings of local and international flights in Kabul International Airport has turned into a familiar scene. On Wednesday, the first official flight of Iran's Mahan Airlines landed in Kabul since Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August.
Iran's Mahan Airlines flight landed in Kabul International Airport with over a dozen Iranian passengers. It would return with tens of passengers, including Afghan nationals.
Earlier, some Qatari and UN-related aircrafts had resumed their flights to and from Kabul International Airport.
There is a Qatari aircraft landing here in the Kabul International Airport. According to Taliban sources, they are struggling to attract more foreign support, especially when it comes to managing the issue of Kabul International Airport.
In the meantime, the Taliban welcomed the resumption of Iran's commercial flights to Kabul, calling on international community to add to the number of their flights, bringing humanitarian aids to Afghanistan.
We welcome the resumption of the international flights, but the fact is our countrymen need urgent humanitarian aid. So I think the resumption of such flights paves the way for the regional countries and international bodies to send more humanitarian aid to Afghanistan.
Tehran was one of the largest donors at the 2002 Tokyo conference, pledging more than India, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Norway, Switzerland, Australia, and Pakistan combined. Iran is also hosting around 3 million Afghans, including around 1 million refugees and 2 million undocumented migrants, according to the United Nations. Many of them have been residing for more than four decades. Kabul International Airport resumes its commercial international flights, while Qatar and Taliban are jointly managing all security and technical issues of the airport. However, Taliban officials here say they are working to make Kabul International Airport fully operational. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell has posed a series of questions to EU legislators in the light of the Afghanistan catastrophe. He asked, what does it mean for our relations with the US? And then he went on.
What does it mean for the development of European strategic autonomy, for our security, and for our defense policy?
During the two-hour European Parliament debate, at least a dozen lawmakers told Borrell the last thing the EU needs is more military spending.
The lessons to be learned. We have to end universal interventionism that has only led to disasters in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Apparently, the West demonstrated enormous arrogance in Afghanistan.
In overshooting self-confidence, instead of helping nation-building, we try to impose nation-building.
The US-led invasion of Afghanistan resulted in a countless number of civilian deaths and also life-changing injuries. We have visited a center for asylum seekers in Brussels. As they wait for help, people here feel let down by EU and Belgian authorities.
They don't care about women, they don't care about children. Why they do like this? What's the difference between Afghanistan and Belgium?
The plight of Afghan refugees was also talked about at length during the European Parliament debate.
The selfishness of many European authorities and political parties that showed no solidarity towards those refugees that left the country.
The reason given for going into the country to defeat terrorism was rubbished.
You were killing innocent people, women and children. You were creating terrorists, fighting migration. You were destroying the place. You were creating migrants.
The European Economic and Social Committee has published a statement pleading with EU leaders to cooperate in a meaningful way with key countries surrounding Afghanistan, including Iran, Pakistan, China, India, and Russia, in order to achieve the stabilization of Central Asia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Turkish foreign minister said that Turkey is working with the United Nations to resettle Syrian refugees in Syria. Mevlut Cavusoglu added that the international community has started to understand the gravity of the situation. Cavusoglu's comments came days after a visit by UNHCR chief Filippo Grandi, who met both the foreign minister and the Turkish president. Cavusoglu underlined the importance not to force the refugees to return, but encourage them through providing them housing, education, health and employment resources.
We are now receiving better support from the international community for the safe return and repatriation of refugees. We are working to repatriate refugees, especially in Syria, especially with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
The AK ruling party is facing criticism from the people and opposition parties for the way it is handling the refugee crisis. Many are blaming the presence of the refugees for the rise in prices and bad economic situation. Turkish people have become very sensitive towards this issue, with some even refusing to deal with foreigners. House owners are now refusing to rent their houses to foreigners, which has created a state of racism in the country that many are calling on the government to find a solution to.
This topic particularly is considered very sensitive to Turkey, and it also concerns other countries in the region that are also hosting refugees, such as Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. Turkey is pushing towards this solution due to several reasons. The main one is the upcoming election and the opposition using the refugee card against the ruling party. Another reason is the people's pressure, who are blaming the presence of Syrian refugees for the deteriorating economic situation in the country. Therefore, the current Turkish government is trying to fix this issue before 2023 elections.
UNHCR says Syria is still considered too dangerous to send refugees back. UNHCR spokesperson says that only a political solution would allow people to return, assuring that refugees should have the right to voluntarily return in safe and dignified conditions. However, several countries, including Turkey, are pressuring the Syrian refugees to return to their home country, claiming it is safe now for their return. Turkey has long been hosting migrants and refugees from different countries in the region. However, with the deteriorating economic situation in the country, people are now calling on their government to stop receiving more refugees and send the already existing ones home. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was supposed to be seamless trading post-Brexit, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the developments of the past few days are a testament. The Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed upon by the UK and EU to avoid trade problems, has become a problem itself. Now the UK is threatening to unilaterally suspend it.
Article 16 says that this article can be triggered unilaterally by either side if there's some aspect of the treaty which is causing unforeseen social, economic or environmental problems. But there's nothing about the way that the Northern Ireland Protocol is operating now which is unforeseen. It has led de facto to a border between the six counties of the north of Ireland and Britain.
The warning came from Brexit Minister Lord Frost, only days after the leader of Northern Ireland's pro-UK ruling party warned of a new era of violence and instability if the protocol collapsed.
That our political institutions will not survive a failure.
The UK has been pushing for a renegotiation of the protocol, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising during Brexit negotiations that it wouldn't impact the flow of goods to and from Northern Ireland.
There will not be checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, because we're the government of the United Kingdom and we will not institute.
A promise Boris Johnson hasn't been able to keep. Instead, he's announced grace periods since January last year to delay the agreement's full implementation. Meanwhile, the European Union, who threatened legal action but are yet to take it, say the UK made its bed and has to lie in it.
They want to have their cake and eat it. They want both to be able to satisfy their own workers at home and have a smash the red wall, claim to be in favour of Brexit, claim to be in favour of British workers, and at the same time be inside the European club.
The agreement was forged to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Republic of Ireland, and to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The two sides agreed that goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK had to be checked according to EU rules. That didn't sit well with the pro-UK unionists.
The Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law. Any violation of it will dent international trust in the government here. And the whole escalating row over the protocol is yet another episode in the ongoing Brexit saga, rekindling questions about whether or not the UK's divorce from the single market was a good idea after all. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning. Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. and I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, is hosting another summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The bloc, which was founded 20 years ago, is a rapidly expanding Eurasian security and economic body led by Russia and China. It has now officially given Iran full membership. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of this unanimous decision as well as the significance of such a bloc known as the Alliance of the East at the time of growing tensions with the West.
Nations Heads of State Summit is being held in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe. Since its foundation 20 years ago, the Eurasian bloc has defined itself as a multilateral organization concentrated on fighting terrorism and extremism, ensuring regional peace and stability, and increasing economic cooperation. The SCO is the largest regional organization in the world in terms of population and territorial coverage. It is home to almost half of the world's population, and its members own nearly a quarter of the global GDP. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy with firm commitments to inclusive multilateralism.
The SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy, promoting multilateralism and fostering cooperation to address the most pressing peace and security issues in Eurasia. The organization represents the largest combined population of any regional grouping in the world. Over 3 billion women and men, more than half of them children and young people.
The SCO members have made significant achievements over the past years in different fields. In 2021, the foreign trade volume of the bloc reached $6.6 trillion, which is 100 times as much as it was 20 years ago. The total economic value of the bloc also stands close to $20 trillion, more than 13 times higher than its initial amount. Moreover, statistics show between 2013 and 2017, the SCO institutions have made great contributions to the global fight against terrorism by preventing hundreds of crimes and arresting thousands of members of terrorist organizations. The successful interaction of the bloc's members has even resulted in the creation of a political term, the Shanghai Spirit, a concept that highlights the association's main principles: decision-making based on mutual respect, equal dialogue, and consideration of the interests of all member states. These principles have paved the way for the development of the organization and the expansion of its influence to such an extent that today, at the time of growing unilateralism across the world, one can consider the SCO a success story of coexistence of diverse states with different ethnic and cultural traditions.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have John Roth, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies. A And also joining us from Potsdam, Germany, we have Harley Schlanger, who is a member of the board of directors of the Schiller Institute.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ross in London. How significant is the full membership of Iran to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Oh, well, I think it's very significant because what this means is that it extends the geographical extent of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization into West Asia, and it means that it covers a much, much greater geographical distance. So this is now a very solid region of support and stability in the world against terrorism, against pressure by the United States, and against all sorts of threats. So this is a very significant positive development.
Mr. Schlanger, over to you in Potsdam. Iran's membership at the SCO. What are the implications for Iran across the board, economically, diplomatically, and et cetera?
Well, it has profound implications in all areas, including the counterterrorism. But I think the one I'd like to focus on is the economic and diplomatic, because part of what was discussed at the SCO meeting today was how to deal with the situation, the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. And the fact that you have most of Afghanistan's neighbors there talking about cooperation, about economic development, not about punishing the country that's already been punished by literally 40 years of war, but the fact that Iran is being included in this is a recognition of the role that Iran can play as part of a stabilizing force in a part of the world that has been subject to destabilization over and over in the recent period.
Mr. Ross, the Iranian president has promised a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. This seems to be a step in that direction, isn't it, in your opinion?
Well, yes, certainly. What is happening, you have see two processes which are overlapping. Iran, the way it expresses it, is look to the east. That is against the type of unilateral sanctions and threats which have come from the United States and which unfortunately have not been resisted enough by Europe. Europe doesn't go on along with it enough, but nevertheless unfortunately hasn't been resisted. And you have then the Belt and Road Initiative, which has come from China, or which is going westwards from China. So, and the two are meeting in the middle. So therefore you have the coming together of a combined vision which is coming out of Iran, coming out of China, and coming out of other countries in there. Then that means also that you have certainly very strongly counter terrorist efforts, etc., coming out of Russia and other countries in the region. So you've got a serious force for stability in a very large part of the world. So this is very good news, both economically and diplomatically, and also for any fight against terrorism. And I agree very much with after the situation in Afghanistan, where the United States has just suffered a catastrophic result, and this will help to stabilize the situation, with Iran entering into this alliance which goes across the whole region.
Mr. Schlanger, in his remarks, the Iranian president, Mr. Raisi, asserted that Iran, his country's foreign policy, is based on opposition to unilateralism, expressing hope that the SCO will become a driving force of global multilateralism. Can you unpack those comments for us, please?
Sure. I mean, what we've seen since the fall of the Soviet Union is the belief among especially Western leaders, largely in NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the belief that the West won the war, and the idea of a rules-based order, which we hear from Secretary of State Blinken all the time, is that the West now makes the rules. Now, these are rules not about peace and stability, but about economic policy, about who can do what. You know, the idea of a rules-based order that tolerates the kinds of wars that have been launched unilaterally, for example, against Libya, against Iraq, against Syria, defending the terrorists in Syria. This is what unilateralism means, the idea that the so-called winners can assert the policy. Now, on the other side, the idea of multilateralism is find means of mutually beneficial cooperation. This is what Xi Jinping of China means by win-win, that you operate on the principle that other nations, instead of competing over scarce resources, work together to develop new kinds of development projects, which is the basis for peace. And I think the important thing is that one of the other things about the SCO is that in collaboration with institutions such as the Asian Development Bank, the China Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, you actually are beginning to put together a certain amount of seed capital to fund these kinds of projects that are the basis of peace, again, based on multilateralism, not unilateral dictates.
Mr. Ross, as a bloc, how do you perceive the functionality of the SCO? What can it do for the region?
Well, the most fundamental question of the SCO is what you might call military political. That's its origins. That is, it's to get rid of any forms of aggression, to get rid of terrorism, and to get rid of unilateral actions by countries outside. Now, within that framework, then it's possible to build economic relations. One will hope that will happen. Certainly, the fact that all the countries in the bloc are against unilateral U.S. economic sanctions is helpful. So, it's the most fundamental is that it's a geopolitical military bloc, but it then contains certain important potentials economically, and in particular, it goes against the sanctions which are going against Iran. So, the fact that it's been admitted into the bloc, which is clearly against the wishes of the United States, shows the solidarity of the other countries within the region against Iran, which will aid regional stability, and hopefully the economic purposes will also develop further within that.
Mr. Schlanger, President Raisi also said, quote, today world peace and security are threatened by hegemony and challenges such as terrorism, extremism, and separatism. Those are some of the issues that you mentioned as well. He also said maintaining and strengthening peace across Asia is not a choice, but a necessity. Does an organization like the SCO fall into bringing about that necessity?
Oh, sure. I mean, because if you look at some of the outstanding issues besides Afghanistan, you have two members, India and Pakistan, both nuclear armed and often at odds with each other. The India-China relationship has not been so good in recent years. However, they share a common interest in economic development of their countries, and importantly, on the idea of sovereignty, which fits in with this question of non-interference of other countries. The SCO has made a big point of this, that there should not be interference in the internal affairs, and that their negotiations and discussions and diplomacy is to enhance the kind of agreements that will allow sovereign nations to work together for mutual benefit. And I think that's really the key to security. What we learned from Afghanistan is that you can't bring peace by war. I don't know if that's been fully understood by the military-industrial complex in the United States, which seems to be itching for a confrontation either with Russia or China. But I think the fact that you have this kind of broad alliance that the SCO represents is an impediment to the unilateral demands or unilateral dreams of the restoring the old geopolitical empire of the Anglo-Americans.
Right. Well, Mr. Ross, a guest that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV on the same issue had this to say. He said we could be seeing the dawn of a new phase of unity in the Eurasian region, specifically with the ugly exit of the U.S. from Afghanistan. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, I think Afghanistan shows that the policy of the United States over the last 20 years or more has been a total failure. I mean, what has happened in Afghanistan, as widely pointed out, is that the United States invaded. It spent $2.3 trillion to get rid of the Taliban, and the Taliban is back in power. You can regard that either as a good or a bad thing, but it's a total failure of the policy of the United States. Therefore, what the SCO is based on is the exact opposite of that, which is you cannot remake a country from outside that by interference in its internal affairs. This is a disastrous failure of the United States. It produces either defeat, as in Afghanistan, or it reduces chaos, as an example, is developed in Libya. So therefore, that's one of the most important things of the SCO. Though doubtless these countries will have various problems and differences and so on and so forth, but they are not subject to the type of fundamentally destabilizing projects which affect the whole of the world, as we've seen with the situation in the United States' intervention in various countries in the region. That's why the SCO is very, very important region. It's a very, very large area of the world in which you don't have this type of intervention, or which is against this type of intervention by the United States.
Right. Mr. Schlanger, you mentioned the issue of sanctions earlier. The Iranian president called the sanctions a big challenge to the world today, saying that domineering states have been using them as a tool to impose their will over others. He also added the sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. How can an organization like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization tackle these challenges, for example, the unilateral sanctions?
Well, let's take one specific example, the so-called Caesar sanctions that have been imposed against Syria. These sanctions say not only that individuals will be hit with financial penalties and seizure of accounts and so on, but that any nation or company that engages in reconstruction in Syria will be penalized to the full extent of the law. Now, that's a violation of every human rights ordinance that is on the books. Now, what can something like the SCO do? Well, you have a question now where the U.S. is imposing these sanctions on Syria. At the same time, it's occupying the oil fields and a lot of the wheat-growing area, and the people of Syria are suffering badly. The Russians did something interesting. They started a means of bringing in food. We just saw the other day the Iranians bring oil to Lebanon. When you have countries that have a commitment to work together, they can find ways to do this. Now, what's the recourse that the sanction imposer can do? Go to war? I mean, at this point, as Professor Ross just pointed out, wars don't work to do this. All they do is destroy. So I think that the ability to get together and work out through discussion process a way of economic cooperation and collaboration is a way around the sanctions. And it will create immediately a confrontation, but that's the kind of confrontation that's necessary because I think at this point, the recourse to war is something that, even in the United States, the American people don't want more wars.
Mr. Ross, President Raisi, he condemned the U.S. for causing chaos in the region, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said Washington needs to be able to account for what it has done in Afghanistan over the past two decades. Also in clear opposition to foreign interference, he stressed that the sole way to establishing security in the region is through regional cooperation. Here, we can insert the SCO, a.k.a. The Alliance of the East. Tell us more.
Well, but this is obviously correct. I mean, look at the record of the United States interventions. What have you produced? You had invasion of Iraq. This produced total destruction in Iraq, and previously very marginal terrorist organizations instead became very powerful. If you look at the situation in Afghanistan, the United States intervened. It spent $2.3 trillion, according to the best estimates, as a result of which is that it was actually military defeated. In Libya, which used to be the richest, most prosperous country in Africa, you now have the open selling of human slaves in Libya and economic chaos. What has this produced? This has produced absolutely catastrophic results. And it just shows you cannot interfere from outside another country's affairs. Countries have their internal equilibrium, their internal forces. Sometimes mistakes will be made. No country in the world is perfect. But the intervention from the outside, invariably, as shown by the United States, produces absolutely disastrous results. And the SCO is against this and is the main regional bulwark of stability in a very large part of the world. Therefore, the inclusion of Iran in this is a very positive situation. Unfortunately, despite these disasters which have occurred with US policy, it's not at all clear that they've learned this lesson. But then the SCO is a powerful bulwark against this type of disaster being foisted on the world. And of course, these types of negative effects they're bad enough, most worse, for the countries in which they occur, but then they also lead to the spread of international terrorism and other things which can destabilize whole regions. This whole policy by the United States has been absolutely disastrous.
Mr. Schlanger, final comments on the issue. The Iranian president stressed that the sole way to establishing security in the region is through regional cooperation. How big of a role can the SCO, which is also known as the Alliance of the East, play in such an equation?
Well, it can play a huge role. I mean, first of all, the whole world needs development. We're teetering on a global financial disaster, economic collapse, again, coming from the same unilateralist policies. The role of the International Monetary Fund to suppress development, the idea to justify intervention under something like Tony Blair's responsibility to protect has been a disaster. Now, what happens when you get powerful nations such as Russia and China, and I would include Iran in that, which has a very important role to play, what happens when those nations show that you can work together? You can overcome disagreements through dialogue, but you can act in concert for the development of the people that are in your neighborhood. And that's initially what the SCO was set out to do, to take a situation that was somewhat chaotic in the region around the collapse of the Soviet Union and bring stability. Now, where was the terrorism coming from? A lot of it was from the outside. And by working together, you create an environment of trust. And that's something that's totally lacking. And just very quickly, what the US and the UK did with the submarine deal with Australia shattered the trust of many in Europe that they could work with the United Kingdom and the United States. So I think the example that can be set by the SCO will have a powerful effect on the whole world.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let's leave it there. Thanks to my guest, John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, joining us from London. And thanks to Harley Schlanger, member of the Board of Directors at the Schiller Institute, speaking to us from Potsdam, Germany. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
The recent Kabul drone strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing at the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the airstrike as a success and preventing a second attack on U.S. forces at Kabul airport. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Larrison, a contributing editor and weekly columnist for antiwar.com website. The piece is titled Shut Down the Drone War. The 29th of August U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, demonstrates the bankruptcy of the so-called war on terror. Like many other drone strikes, the strike in Kabul targeted innocent people and achieved nothing except to blow up civilians that had the misfortune to be in the vicinity. According to 2 recent investigative reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post, the vehicle targeted in the airstrike carried no explosives whatsoever, and the car's driver was Zamari Ahmadi, an aid worker who had spent the day delivering water to those in need. Hailed as a righteous strike by the U.S. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Kabul drone strike was an atrocity that should never have happened. The Biden administration has emphasized that the U.S. possesses over-the-horizon capabilities to continue waging war in Afghanistan even after the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from the country. But the 29th of August airstrike shows why the U.S. should not be using them. The recent Kabul strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing of the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the strike as a success in preventing a second attack on U.S. forces. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. As Ahmadi's brother, Amal, told the New York Times, "All of them were innocent. You say he was Daesh, but he actually worked for the Americans." The U.S. military has defended the airstrike, but all of their specific claims fall apart under scrutiny. U.S. officials claim there was a secondary explosion that proves the explosives were present in the car, but according to investigative reports, no such second explosion occurred. The objects that they believe to be explosives were in fact water containers. Despite surveying Ahmadi for 8 hours on that day, they managed to get every important detail wrong about what he was doing, who he was with, and what he was transporting. The killing of these 10 innocent people is an outrage, but the bigger outrage is that this strike is not an outlier. Things like this have been happening in Afghanistan as well as in other countries for years, but they have received little or no attention. When these attacks take place in remote areas, as they often do, it is difficult for investigators and journalists to determine what really happened. Because the strike occurred in a major city, there were lots of witnesses and journalists could piece together the evidence much more easily. Who knows how many other innocent people have been targeted in the same way that Zamari Ahmadi was? How many people have been executed like this, simply for going about their daily business? Who seriously believes that this has anything to do with the security of the United States? Thanks to Daniel Hale's whistleblowing, we now know that the US drone warfare frequently kills civilians, and in some cases, most or all of the victims are actually civilians. As Daniel Hale has said, with drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. Many of the people targeted by drone strikes are not necessarily even militants, but just happen to be military-age males. Because the military wrongly assumes that everyone killed in an airstrike is an enemy combatant, unless proven otherwise, the number of civilians killed by US drone strikes is bound to be considerably higher than the government acknowledges. US military has actually made a habit of either not counting or undercounting the civilian victims of US airstrikes and drone strikes. The US-led bombing campaign against Daesh in Iraq killed many thousands of innocent civilians, but the military acknowledged only a very small number of these. Asmat Khan and Anand Gopal reported in 2017, we found that 1 in 5 of the coalition airstrikes we identified resulted in civilian deaths, a rate more than 31 times that acknowledged by the coalition. It is at such a distance from official claims that, in terms of civilian deaths, this may be the least transparent war in recent American history. U.S. airstrikes in Somalia have killed dozens of civilians, but U.S. AFRICOM Command has acknowledged only 5. The Kabul airstrike fits into this pattern. 10 people were killed, but the US military owned up only to killing 3 adults. Drone strikes have served as the background noise of US warfare for the last decade and a half, and as such, they are mostly ignored until they cause enough loss of life to register briefly on the radar of Western media outlets. The drone war has continued across 4 administrations, and in recent years the conduct of that war and the casualties that it has caused have been increasingly difficult to track. If Americans had a clearer view of who the victims of drone strikes really are, more of us would realize that the drone war needs to be shut down. It is not making the US any safer, and even if it were doing so at the margins, it comes at an unacceptably high price in terms of innocent lives lost. No government has the right to do what ours did to these 10 people in Afghanistan. And there is no justification for continuing a policy that regularly results in such slaughter.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.